Joining us in today's episode, we have Trey Vassallo, Managing Director of Defy and Kauffman Fellow from Class 10. Listen as she describes her unconventional story from growing up in rural Minnesota to earning her mechanical engineering degree at Stanford University, to becoming a partner at Kleiner Perkins, to ultimately co-founding her own venture firm. She often says throughout the podcast that following her instincts and pursuing the things that made her happy helped her take big risks and ultimately led her to where she is today. Don't miss her describing her unique interactions with famous venture capitalist John Doerr or her advice for getting people to want to help you on your journey. We can't wait to share her story with you. Okay, we're excited to have Trey Vassallo with us today. For listeners, here's a quick bio on Trey. Trey Vassallo is a co-founder and managing director of Defy, an early-stage venture capital firm. In addition to Defy, Trey is on the board of directors at Telstra, an international telecommunications company. Trey recently co-authored the study Elephant in the Valley to help highlight the underlying data around the experiences of women in technology. She was previously a general partner at Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield & Byers. Over her 14-year investing career, Trey invested in a number of leading companies, including Eero, Nest Labs, Dropcam, Aggregate Knowledge, and Opower. Great companies. Before joining Kleiner Perkins, Trey was a co-founder of Good Technology, a Kleiner Perkins portfolio company that provides end-to-end wireless email services to the enterprise customers. Trey began her career at IDEO, where she developed groundbreaking products for companies including Palm and Dell. Trey holds 13 patents across a broad array of technologies and disciplines. Trey earned a bachelor's degree and master's degree in mechanical engineering from Stanford University and an MBA from the Stanford Graduate School of Business. And Trey is a Kauffman Fellow from Class 10. Wow, that is an impressive bio. Thanks for joining us today, Trey.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
It's awesome to have you with us. So Trey, what we want to do with you is you have so much ground to cover and so much experience to bring to this this conversation. I would love to just to start with some of your formative experiences as a child. Tell me a little bit about your background, where you were born, your family structure. I'd love to learn a little bit about that from you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I do think it is an important element because where you come from really shapes how you think. And I do love to tell people that I am from rural Minnesota, which, you know, is kind of hard to explain to people out on the coast, small farming town. You know, most people I went to school with didn't really even leave the state. Some went to college, not all went to college. And our school didn't even offer, you know, like the SAT, for example. So it was an interesting place to grow up.
That's incredible. Tell me about your family. What does your family do? If you're, you know, based in Minnesota, how did you get there? Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So my parents, you know, basically grew up in rural Minnesota. Their parents were farmers, children of immigrants. And so my mom and dad, my dad was an NCAA athlete. He kind of put himself through school, became a doctor, and decided that he wanted to bring, you know, his medical skills to rural Minnesota. And so we moved back out from the Twin Cities to, you know, a small town, you know, farming community where he started his ophthalmology practice. And, you know, it is funny because I actually remember going to his graduation from med school because I was born prior to him going to med school. And so I was there to see the whole thing. And it is interesting that, you know, he was very much a doctor, but he was also a small business owner. And so I got to watch him, you know, create this business from scratch. And, you know, I was a big part of it. So I was the person he used to experiment on when he was testing out new equipment. And I was the person who would help him, you know, enter data. And the cool thing is he really embraced technology early on. And so it was really great to watch him bring computers into the doctor's office. And he actually wrote, you know, programs that allowed him to manage his business. And, you know, and I would help him. And in fact, in seventh grade, I started working in his office in the summers, you know, on the back office side, mostly data entry and things like that. But it was great to have a front row seat to such a, you know, kind of an entrepreneurial endeavor, and also one where, you know, here is a person who's changing people's lives by giving them their vision back. And so it was a fun thing to see. And in fact, my dad's actually retiring in March. So we're all going to go back and really celebrate, you know, what he's done. And, you know, I think the impact that it had on all of us as kids.
Sounds like an amazing man. And as we all know, behind an amazing man, there's also an amazing woman. And I'm sure that your mom was equally as awesome with the things that she did. Did you, as you were growing up, you obviously, I mean, 13 patents, holy cow. Obviously, you have a intellectual curiosity and a builder mindset with how you explore bringing new technologies to bear. Did you get some of that from your mom, from your dad? Where did that come from?
You know, I'd say absolutely both of them. We did grow up in rural America, on a pseudo farm, I joke. So we grew up with animals. We grew up with tractors. It was very hands-on. You know, I was chopping wood using a log splitter, using all sorts of equipment as a young kid. And always solving problems. You know, something's always breaking, you got to fix something. And, you have to basically figure out how to get it done. And, you know, I think both of my mom and dad had this incredible work ethic that we learned from early on.
What was your favorite tool or invention or something that you remember from that early childhood? As you say, you fixed a lot of things, you used a lot of tools. Give us a little bit more insight there. What was your favorite?
Well, so, you know, the Minnesota school system at the time was super innovative. And one of the things they did was bring Apple computers into the classroom very early. And it really was transformative. You know, this was the introduction of, you know, sort of the computing for consumers. And I was really lucky to be in this program where they'd pull students out of class and give them exposure to sort of, you know, other technologies and problem solving and computers. And so from a pretty early on time frame, I remember kind of third grade, fourth grade, being able to spend hours, playing around on these Apple IIs in the library, and just, you know, it was just magic when you figured out how you could program the little cursor on the screen and then, you know, design a design and then animate it. And so that definitely created a spark for me that was like, okay, this is a really useful tool. And programming sort of became a theme and something that I really enjoyed throughout my high school.
You were part of that generation in that unique point in time where elementary school, middle school, you had access to computers and everybody was just starting to learn them, just starting to see what the capacity or the capabilities were and playing around and inventing and programming. That's amazing. Awesome, Trey. So let's go to middle school, maybe starting to get into high school a little bit. As you were starting to think through, you know, you have this father that's a doctor that was involved in NCAA athletics. What did you envision for yourself? Like, what did young Trey want to be when she grew up?
Yeah. Well, you know, I wish I could say I knew what I wanted to be. I loved sports. I was an athlete, like actually both mom and dad. But I also knew I was a problem solver, loved math, technology. I was also inspired by medicine, loved the fact that as a doctor, you know, it was very kind of science focused and was an occupation where you could help people. And pretty early on, my dad gave me a lot of feedback around, you know, don't go into medicine. And, I think a lot of his feedback came from the transition that he saw of it going from being a business where he could own and operate his own business to one that was consolidating, where doctors were becoming more, you know, part of a service organization. And so that actually influenced my thinking quite a bit. And so, you know, it wasn't until I actually got to college where, you know, I basically said, I think I generically want to do engineering. Engineering is all about problem solving, creative problem solving, using, you know, lots of different tools. But I had no idea what kind of engineering, electrical, mechanical, computer programming, which I loosely kind of put all together within engineering. And for me, ultimately, I ended up deciding on mechanical engineering for a couple of reasons. The first one was, you know, as I looked at the landscape, mechanical to me felt like, you know, the most all-encompassing of all the engineering skills. It was sort of the thing that brought everything together. If you're going to build a product, you have to have the electrical engineering, you have to have the programming, and you have to have the mechanical, and it's all got to come together within this mechanical package. And, you know, I was really fortunate that I ended up at Stanford for my undergrad. And the mechanical engineering program at Stanford is really special in that it has housed over the years what eventually became the D school. You know, this is where David Kelly and a lot of the IDEO folks basically grew up. And so mechanical engineering at Stanford isn't just, you know, fluid design, you know, computational fluid design and, you know, statics and, you know, turbine design and things like that. But it's it's, you know, design thinking and creative problem solving and, you know, just this much bigger notion of what engineering means. And that I found incredibly inspiring. And a lot of people will point to this particular class at Stanford called visual thinking. That is a class that I recommend anyone who's at Stanford should absolutely take this class. And it, what it basically proves to you is no matter how uncreative you think you are, you know, you are way more creative and you can do way more with way less than you ever thought you could do. It's, you know, it's the type of class that says, you know, here's some spaghetti and some tape, you know, build a bridge that spans, you know, 15 feet kind of thing. And inevitably, you know, the teams in this class come up with these crazy, amazing designs. And, you know, it's incredibly fulfilling. It's fun. You know, you have this sense of accomplishment when you're done and the teamwork is just phenomenal. And so, you know, the combination of that class, the philosophy at Stanford, you know, that IDEO influence, the D school, basically just pulled me towards mechanical engineering.
I've heard about this class and I got to say, I'm super jealous for not having ever been able to attend that class and benefit from it. I want to go back just a half step here, though. So you come from a rural town in Minnesota with, you know, a school district that didn't even offer the SATs, and then you jump forward to Stanford. What was that like? What were some of those feelings coming from a small town to one of the preeminent universities in the country, in addition to which has one of the preeminent mechanical engineering departments in the country? That must have been a unique transition. That is a pretty big leap.
It was kind of funny because, you know, I didn't really know what to think. It's not like, you know, I never did any college tours. You know, basically I did all of my research based on buying a U.S. News and World Report that basically just listed, you know, here are the top engineering schools. And I remember thinking to myself, well, you know, I should pick an East Coast one and a West Coast one. And then obviously University of Minnesota. And, you know, I had no idea what I was doing. And in our guidance counselor at the school, you know, just it wasn't used to counseling people like me who really wanted to, you know, go far away and try different things. And so I was kind of on my own. And, you know, I think I was fortunate in that I was just so driven to try something new, get to a coast. Ended up taking my SATs at a university that was about 2 hours away from my high school. So I did get those, done. Wow. And then I applied early to MIT, and I applied to Stanford, and those were my kind of two big stretch schools. And MIT was my dream school. You know, I had read about it, you know, just had this kind of massive, you know, thing in my head about what an amazing place that would be for me. And I remember I got in early and I went to go visit it. And this is my first college visit that I'd done. And I got there and I remember being really surprised because, you know, I'm from a very, very, very small town. And I had no idea this concept of like urban schools versus rural schools. And you know, I was sort of like, where's the campus? You know, it's sort of, it is, you know, if you've been to MIT, which is, you know, obviously I love MIT, but it's an urban campus. Yeah. And it was also the middle of winter and, you know, being from Minnesota and going to another place with, you know, unhappy cold people everywhere. It was sort of, when I got there, I was like, I'm not sure this is the place for me. It just, you know, felt so out of sorts for me. And, you know, the saving grace was that while I was there and kind of going through my like, oh, my goodness, you know, here's my dream. And I'm not sure that's the right place for me now. I found out I got into Stanford. And so I accepted Stanford sight unseen. And, you know, when I eventually came out and did that drive down Palm Drive, I was like, oh, my goodness. You know, it's sort of like that. I won the lottery. I had no idea what I was getting myself into.
Does not look like MIT.
No, it's very different. I mean, obviously, and I adore MIT, so I don't mean to knock MIT at all. But, you know, for the country bumpkin in me, Stanford was the perfect place to go. You know, that still gave me a bit of the outdoorsiness aspects that I needed, you know, as well as allowed me to go really deep in some incredible areas like mechanical engineering and then robotics.
And so now I don't know what the class breakdown was in mechanical engineering robotics, but I have to imagine that the gender balance in that major was not exactly balanced. What was that like?
Yeah, well, in particular, yeah, mechanical engineering and then You know, I stayed in co-term to get my master's in mechanical engineering. And in my master's, I focused on, it was called smart product design at the time. And it was basically, you know, robotics or electromechanical engineering. And I remember there's this iconic class where it's a, you know, it's a year long class where you're building, you know, autonomous robots and, you know, there's, several different competitions that you enter into. And I think I, if I remember right, I was one of like seven women in a class of 70 people. And it's an intense class, but I loved it so much. You know, I TA'd it the following year and it really defined a lot of kind of what inspired me. And grads from that class, by the way, have gone on to, you know, co-found companies like Square and, you know, help drive Tesla and Apple. And so that class graduates a ton of amazing talent that now, you know, drives a lot of, you know, kinds of companies we'd love to invest in, which is great.
So inspirational, your story. So let's fast forward now to, you know, venture capital. So how did you end up in venture capital? Kind of give us the pivotal moments going from your starts to your journey through Kleiner to now being with Defy. Can you give us kind
of a sure. Well, I'd say the first thing is that, you know, I, especially being in college, I never thought I would end up in venture. You know, it was, for me, it was very much kind of one step at a time. You know, I studied mechanical engineering at Stanford and then kind of fell into a job at IDEO because, you know, IDEO was sort of, that was the company that I held in such high regard when I was a student at Stanford as, you know, that is the ultimate place to work. And, you know, frankly, was able to then get a job there that really did help me kind of understand what does it take to actually, you know, understand users' problems and then build a product that is tailor-made to solve those problems. So the whole process of design thinking and building, you know, finding that product market fit and then actually executing on that product, you know, I was able to practice and execute on at IDEO under the context of some incredible brands like Dell and Palm. And I always love to talk about the story where, you know, there are these really pivotal moments in my life where, you know, I guess I'm open to taking some big risks. And the time at IDEO when I was working on the Palm 5 was transformative for me because it was the first time that I really got exposure to a startup. And this was, you know, Palm Computing, which had just launched its Palm Pilot, and it was sort of an overnight success. And they were a young company and trying to figure out how to, you know, build their next product. So they hired IDEO, an outsourced engineering firm. And so that was really exciting to work with this cool new company. But even more interesting for me was the fact that, you know, Donna Dubinsky was the CEO of this company, and I had never worked with a female CEO or seen one. And she was so inspiring. And that basically got me thinking that, you know, I love doing what I'm doing, but I can't imagine kind of being a consulting engineer for the rest of my career. So if I want to be more like Donna, you know, I've got to position myself and get some additional skills. And so, you know, I went back to business school and basically it was Stanford or bust because I knew I wanted to stay in the entrepreneurial ecosystem. And luckily they took me back. And so I ended up going to business school in the fall of 1998, which was kind of a crazy time when you think about it. You know, I was in business school through the extreme boom of the 1999 and then graduated into the bust of 2000. And so our class, you know, it's funny because we sort of looked foolish while everyone was minting money overnight in their startup, you know, we're going to class, which didn't seem right at the time. And then when we graduated, I think half of the class had a job, but then was unemployed right away because, you know, last in, first out. So that was pretty interesting.
Wow.
But back to your question about how do you get into venture, I'm getting there, but it's sort of a long windy story here. Cause it is because, you know, venture is something
they
you
always
fall
are.
Into as opposed to, you know, make happen. And for me, you know, all of my, I think, career experiences build on each other. And, you know, I had just gotten done building and shipping the Palm 5 at IDEO, which was at the time this incredible kind of successful handheld. And then at business school, what I wanted to do is figure out how I could take the experiences that I'd had at IDEO and build on them to build something entrepreneurial. And the thing that was frustrating to me is, you know, here it's 1999 and all the companies, you know, there's no element of the physical world anywhere. These are just all internet companies, which is good and bad. It was exciting because, you know, there's this revolution in the internet, but how are my skills going to be relevant to these types of companies? And so one day, John Doerr was coming to our class to talk about Netscape and the Netscape case. And I happened to see him standing outside the classroom before class. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, you can do it. You know, muster up that courage, go up and say hi to him. Because I'll say the other thing that I was working on in business school was, you know, I was that super shy, quiet engineering nerd. I'm still that way, but I have learned over the years that, you know, pushing myself, getting out of my shell, talking to people, engaging people, asking for what you need help with, you know, these are all really important skills. And I needed to get better at that. And so here was my opportunity. I saw John standing there and I mustered up the courage and I walked over to him and basically said, you know, hey, it's so great to meet you. You know, obviously I'm a big fan. But I wanted to get your advice. And I told him, you know, I'm here at the business school because I just finished launching this Palm 5, which is an amazing product. But, you know, clearly, you know, the internet is really important. And it's surprising to me that, you know, devices like the Palm 5, you know, aren't connected to the internet. And that has to change. And I would love to find an opportunity that is focused on those things, you know, and then I very specifically asked him, do you know of anything or anyone kind of working in that area? Because I would love to get connected. And surprisingly, he was like, absolutely, actually I do. You know, there's a team of folks that are working on that right now. You know, I'd love to connect you. Let me get your contact information. And the kind of crazy takeaway for me from this conversation for me was when you can be very specific about a need that you have, you know, people really want to help you. And so if you can ask for their help in a way that is relatively easy for them to, you know, agree to help you, they want to do that. It's when things are too vague or too open-ended, it actually is really hard to help. But like, it was easy for him to introduce me to a couple of folks on his team who were working on this problem. And, you know, and then 3 months later, we co-founded Good Technology. You know, John Seed Invested was on our board. And, you know, I was able to make my transition to kind of entrepreneur with a couple of other co-founders who, you know, brought very different skills to the business. And, you know, that was an amazing, amazing experience where, you know, I got to basically help start this business, help grow it to about 300 people. You know, at that point, you know, there was an interesting, you know, transition when we got to 300 people. It's 2002. The market is still dismal. And the company is trying to figure out how to manage cash. And we come to the decision we have to get rid of hardware. And hardware was the thing, of course, I was leading and spending my time on and the thing I was most qualified
most passionate
to do
about. Yeah.
Time. And so, so basically, you know, a couple of years in, I'm out of a job. And, you know, and the company is continuing to do well. And I remember reaching back to John Doerr and saying, you know, and he actually was like, Trey, do you have any sense of what you're going to do next? And again, I don't know what inspired me to say this, but I'm sure glad I did. I said, you know, I don't really know what I'm going to do next, but I'm sure if I were working with you, I could figure that out more quickly. I basically just asked him for a job.
Well played.
And literally the next day I was an EIR, an entrepreneur in residence at Kleiner, which, you know, is a great chance to basically just, you know, have a desk, sit for a while, kind of get your bearings, and then look at the landscape and figure out what's out there. And so, you know, so that's kind of how I initially ended up at Kleiner. And then how I ended up converting that into an associate role was sort of another funny set of experiences. I you know, was doing that for about 9 months and got really close on starting a company that didn't end up working out because we had some IP issues. And, you know, it's end of 2002, 2003, I have a 9-month-old baby at home and I have a husband in business school. So, you know, so I'm the person who's supposed to be bringing home the salary. And so, you know, I basically was like, okay, you know, this EIR thing has been really interesting and fun. But I actually need income. I need to support my family. And so a friend of mine who was working on this emerging new product from Apple called the iPod was begging me to interview with the iPod team. So I did, and ended up getting a job offer from Apple. And so I went back to the Kleiner folks and I was like, you know, thank you so much. This has been great, but I need to start making some money. And, I've got this offer over at Apple. I'll be doing that. And John was like, no, wait, we love working with you. Why don't you stay? We'll make you an associate. and so that's, and for me, I was like, okay, I could go make another handheld, and I already shipped two by that time. Or I could try something totally different that built off my skill set in a completely different way. And kind of, just allowed me, I think, a different type of personal growth. And so, I was like, sure, I'll take this kind of crazy risk. And, 11 years later, I was a GP and, it was an incredible, run at Kleiner. So.
I just love that story. There's so much to learn from that. Are there any other, and feel free to add to that if you want to, but I guess my follow-on is, in this spirit of taking big risks or big risk-taking moments, you've now had a long career in venture. What are some, is there maybe one other, or I'd say one other example that sticks out to you as a big risk-taking moment, either for you, something that you went through where maybe other people doubted you or didn't believe in you and you did it anyway, and how that turned out?
Yeah, well, so I'm laughing because that is, I'd say, a theme through my life is kind of not listening to what other people are telling me is the right thing to do, but following my own instincts and basically doing what I know is going to make me happy. And so like, if I had to point to kind of one theme that keeps popping up again and again, it's that. It's, no one in Minnesota was telling me, hey, you should go to a coast, go as far away as possible from home, because that's going to be really good for you. But my heart was telling me that. And so I did that. And then, the whole going to business school choice, that's a big career choice to go from being an engineer to, quote unquote, the dark side. I got so much crap from all my friends for doing that. Had I listened to them, I never would have done that. I'd say the same thing for kind of staying at Kleiner. That wasn't necessarily the obvious route, given kind of all the things in front of me. And I'd say that kind of the recent thing that has been a big risk-taking thing for me was the whole, starting a new firm. That's a massive risk. When you leave a big platform and a big brand, and then kind of invest the time and effort into, building a new partnership and building a new firm, you're starting over and you're kind of, throwing it all in a hat and seeing what comes out. And, that was a big risk. But I think what inspired me about it was I got to build on, my 11 incredible years at Kleiner, being in an amazing, place that had an incredible brand and an incredible infrastructure. And I got to take away what I learned from the investing side, but now I'm getting to learn, here's what it means to build a firm from scratch. And here's what it means to build a culture and build an LP base and all the other things that I didn't have to do when I was at Kleiner. I'm getting to do that now. And so, I'd say that I love pushing myself. I love the ability to be able to look back and go, I didn't know how to do this, a year ago, 2 years ago. And I may not be an expert now, but boy, have I made a ton of progress. And I love that I at least have a point of view on how to do this now. And so, we're a couple of years in on this firm, but there's never been anything that's been, more fulfilling than, being able to be both an entrepreneur again, but also combine my love of investing together with this. And so it's been absolutely amazing.
So proud of what you're building at Defy. What's in your journey through Kaufman? What kind of role did Kaufman Fellows play in that? I guess not only your journey through Kaufman, but in your journey through your career. Where was Kaufman, and kind of what the role did it play in your career?
Yeah, well, so I fell into Kleiner as an associate, And it was a great place to be able to shadow some amazing people, but it was really, you were sort of learning by osmosis as opposed to kind of learning through explicit conversation. And there's, it's, you know, also terrified of bringing up like stupid questions and things like that in an environment where people are expecting you to know how to do everything. And so for me, you know, I think if I remember right, you know, Kauffman happened after I'd been at Kleiner for a couple of years. So I had a pretty decent, you know, sense of, you know, how to work a little bit on the investing side. But what I loved about the program is that it gave me the opportunity to ask those dumb questions and have a bit more of an academic sense of, oh, okay, this is why this, you know, term really exists and that sort of thing. But, you know, so the academic side is great. But then I think, you know, again and again, what people will tell you is it's the people you meet and the networks that get created that go on to create, you know, incredible value over time. And so when you look at kind of all the amazing people who come through the Kauffman program and meet because of the Kauffman program, you know, that's, you know, just an incredibly powerful piece of the value that the program's created.
In true Kauffman Fellows fashion, I want to ask you two more self-reflective questions. The first would be, you know, we go through this kind of some call it the decade of decision-making, kind of your 17 to 27, where you're deciding on school, you're deciding on, you know, post-school, college, or, you know, after you graduate, what job you're going to do. Some people get married in that time frame, lots of different decisions that you make. If you were to look back at, let's say, 25-year-old Trey,
yep.
what advice would you give, or what would you say to 25-year-old Trey, knowing now what you know? Maybe it's advice. Maybe it's offering some sense of gratitude for the work that she did. What would you tell 25-year-old Trey if you had that opportunity?
Huh. Okay, so I think 25-year-old Trey was getting her guts together to go to business school. So I think I would just be super encouraging, because, you know, I think that if I'm remembering that time, you know, correctly, I remember just not having a lot of certainty, like, oh goodness, you know, I'm taking this big risk. It could be completely wrong. And I have all my friends telling me I'm being an idiot, but there's something inside that's telling me that this is the right thing. And so, you know, I think it would just be more encouraging and enthusiastic. And, you know, if I were then to say, like, how do I translate that into advice I give other people? It's, you know, be open to the things that come at you. I think so many people are closed to opportunities that present themselves. You know, it's like the immediate no versus the, okay, what could I do with this? And how could this bring me to a new place? And, you know, I think for whatever reason, actually, it's probably my parents, but they gave me this sense of confidence that I could handle anything. And so, you know, if I have the opportunity to do something, you know, take a good solid look at it, because, you know, it actually might lead me in a crazy new, wonderful direction. And you know, I think I've certainly gotten more confident with that kind of risk-taking ability over time. It's worked enough times for me that, you know, I think my biggest risk I've taken is my most recent risk in helping start my new firm. And I think I've done that with a lot more self-confidence than I had earlier in life. So, you know, I'd say you know, it's hard to try to do this stuff when you don't have a lot of confidence. So I'd say that would be the biggest thing I would try to just, you know, help instill and give more confidence.
As we approach inflection points in our life or risk-taking moments, it's so the natural first question that we ask ourselves is what could go wrong? Mm-hmm. And you programmed yourself to ask the opposite question, which is so important, is what could go right?
That's right.
That's really great. Okay, last question for you, which is, if you had one wish, you had a genie in a bottle, and that genie in a bottle gave you one wish, what would that wish be?
Oh my goodness. What would that wish be? Wow. That's a big question. One wish. Well, you know, I'll tell you, obviously something that's been, you know, and you've touched on this in this conversation, you know, I've got two daughters, I've spent my career in industries where, you know, women have had to, you know, work twice as hard, push harder to sort of achieve the same success. So my wish would be that, you know, we continue to make such incredible progress in all areas around kind of just empowering women, but having the equal opportunity for men and women in, you know, all areas of tech. You know, I sort of see it changing, and that's exciting. And I just hope that doesn't slow down.
Hey everyone, hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you haven't already, sign up for our newsletter to get notified of the latest release, as well as to receive our acclaimed research and insights into VC and startups. Lastly, show us some love on Twitter at Coffin Fellows. We'll see you next week.